when the Navy cruiser, the USS Indianapolis, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. On July 30th, 1945, three brave men managed to put on life jackets and jump ship as they prepared to fight for their lives in shark-infested waters. Art Lienerman, Earl Riggins, and Don McCall were among the 1,197 crew members on board in the South Pacific just after midnight at 12:14 a.m.
Well, I'd been on duty that night, supposed to get relieved a quarter till 12, and got relieved late, got relieved about close to midnight, and I left my station, and which was topside, and went back to the head or the John, whatever you want to call it, and I was in there when the ship got hit. Got a life jacket, went back to my general quarters station, and I was there for just a few minutes, and I told this other friend of mine, I said, I think this thing's gonna ship, we better get off of here.
I looked in the water, and it was full of guys that didn't have life jackets, and I said, this is wrong. So I put it on, and I jumped, I think, about 60 or 70 feet into the water, but I knew I had to swim away from the ship because of the suction of the ship will pull you down if you don't get away from it. And I swam as far as I could and stopped and turned around and watched it go down.
You said you turned back and looked at the ship. You remember how the ship stood straight up in
yep.
the air when it went down, it went straight down.
Despite the fact that SOS messages were sent and received, no report was ever filed when the ship failed to arrive on schedule in Leyte on July 31st. The heavy cruiser was returning to the Philippines after delivering components for the atomic bomb.
Next morning, though, we all thought that they'd be looking for us and thought maybe we'd possibly got off an SOS. The radio man thought so. Nobody knew for sure. The first day wasn't too alarming. It was when you got around the second day, no one showed up. And the sharks did, though. The sharks got pretty familiar with us.
Sometimes during the daytime and sometimes at night you could hear airplanes flying over or whatever, but you know, you can't hardly see anything in the water, so they wouldn't be able to see us at all.
Long days and longer nights, it seemed like, wasn't it?
Well, even Wilbur Gwynn said he couldn't see us in the water at first, he just saw the oil slick.
But before the pilot, Wilbur Gwynn, arrived, these three men and nearly 900 others drifted, prayed, or hallucinated during the five-day wait for rescue. Some men were so dehydrated they had no choice but to drink the water and pay the price. The salt water sent them to their death.
Well, a lot of fellows
did drink it
and they'd hallucinate. They come to me, my best friend comes to me the afternoon before the plane spotted us and said, Earl, he said, the Indies just under the water, he said, scuttlebutts was the water cooler. Still working, he said, the water's good, come on, go with me. And I said, Bob, stay here. And I'm going. I reached out to grab him, and he was gone. And it wasn't long before I heard screams. Now, I'm not saying the sharks got him, but that's the usual thing. We heard his screams, but it was the sharks, of course.
Art, Earl, and Don endured the constant patrol of hungry predators from dusk to dawn.
The sharks were there, but you're so petrified that, you know, you're just absolutely, you're trying to survive, and you're doing everything you can. At first, they beat the water. I thought that's not a good idea because that attracts them. So after that, I swam away a little bit by myself, and I just doubled up in a ball when I seen them.
Whenever they decided they were hungry, there wasn't much anything you could do about it.
A lot of the guys, some of them didn't have life jackets, and we took life jackets off of some of the dead guys. And
that's when you can see when the
bodies would sink away.
We did the same thing, be just a half body left. And we were saving life, and I'm sure they were too. We were saving life rafts, or jackets, because some people didn't have them, and because life jackets were given out. The older jackets did give out, I think.
They did.
Mine was still, I was still, I was about here, but it was still floating me. But
struggling in harsh conditions in that same Pacific Sea was the ship's captain, Charles McVeigh III. Though he survived, the captain was court-martialed and convicted of hazarding his ship by failing to zigzag. He was informed his route would be safe. Knowing that another ship sank in that same area the previous week, McVeigh requested an escort ship. His request was denied.
They said that that the moonlight was out, and I was on watch till midnight, and I'm telling you, it was pitch dark out. There was no moon. After we were in the water for a while, you could see glimpses of it, but it was a dark, gloomy night.
Captain McVeigh had orders that he could zigzag at his own discretion. Well, like Don said, it got dark and it was cloudy that night, and so about 10, 11 o'clock or late that evening, well, they decided to not zigzag anymore, and they just had a straight course. But the ironic thing about the whole thing is the captain asked for a escort at Guam, and they told him he didn't need it. But then after the war was over, we found out that a week before that, a destroyer had got sunk in that same area that we were going through. So somebody out there dropped the ball.
The sinking of the Indianapolis troubled McVeigh for years. In 1968, he committed suicide. Following his death, survivors and others organized a campaign to clear his name. In the year 2000, the captain was finally exonerated by the U.S. Congress. Had McVeigh survived, he would have learned the Navy feared exposure of their most closely guarded secret. They had broken Japan's naval codes. Art, Earl, and Don were among the 317 who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. They believe their strength to survive came from enduring much hardship while growing up on the farm.
My mother had four children. My dad died when I was about 10, and I had to survive by hunting rabbits and picking up coal on a railroad track, and I had a hard time. We raised gardens and chickens and pigs, and that's what kept us alive.
You're working out there on a farm in the sun, and it's 100 degrees in the shade, and you know, you're pitching bundles onto a rack wagon and hauling them to the thrash machine, and you're beating on a pair of old mules trying to keep them going.
I had uncles on the farm. I spent all summer helping bale hay and you know, various things, and worked on the farm. You get toughed up to those kind of things.
Those tough times prepared them for the greatest, most heroic challenge of their lives.
People like to call us heroes, and I was an air sea lookout, and I watched the guys land on Tarawa the first time. The heroes are still out there. We're just survivors, and the reason we survived was because we had somebody watching over us.
Yeah, they talk about the football players being heroes or baseball players being heroes. That's far from being heroes. Like Don says, it's those boys that give their lives to this country.
Well, the whole thing about the whole thing is that we survived, and we were able to have a family and grandkids and all these other young guys that didn't survive. They didn't have a chance. When rain has hung the leaves with tears, I want your name.